Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the ongoing evolution of our consciousness, and that is why I'm talking today to Brad Olson, someone I met, was it last year, 2 years ago?
About 2 or 3 years ago at the Book Expo in New York.
Yeah, he gave me a great book called Future Esoterica, all about UFOs and what's happening behind the scenes. But it also happens that Brad will be speaking this year at Contact in the Desert. That is June 3rd to the 6th at Joshua Tree, California. And you can get tickets for that at contactinthedesert.com. And you'll be a great addition to have there, along with so many other well-known speakers in the field. Well, thanks for being here and there, Brad.
Well, thank you for having me, Alan. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, because I welcome anyone who's really devoted sort of a lifetime of research into this. I would say it's a popular topic, but it's also an unpopular topic. And we're sort of in between those people wanting to ridicule it and those opening up to these possibilities. You know what I mean? It's a very strange place to be in. Do you find yourself in that position sometime?
Well, for sure. When I took on the task of doing this esoteric series, and there are two books out right now, we're going to be talking about Future Esoteric, which does have all the information I've collected on the ET Enigma and UFOs. And it can't, Alan, I really don't think it can, because what I cover in the esoteric series is what I call this alternative narrative, that is the storyline behind all the things that have been hidden from us. And certainly, I've filled a 416-page book based on a decade of research into a subject that just cannot be swept under the rug. This is very much a real phenomenon. There are millions of witnesses worldwide to UFOs, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, who have experienced abduction and up-close, face-to-face contact, and people like myself who have seen phenomenon that just cannot be explained. So I set out to try to come to some conclusions, at least have some clarity for myself what exactly is going on here. And even though it's an unpopular subject to some people, it's extremely fascinating to others. So The nature of the word esoteric means it's information that's sought out by a select few. I hope it's those people with insatiable curiosity, myself and yours, who will take a chance with this book and this interview and hear what we have to say.
So let's talk about, you said there's three books in the Esoterica series. So this one is the future about ETs and the future of the planet. What are the other books in your series?
So Modern Esoteric is book one, and that basically taking a look all the way back to human origins, to antediluvian civilizations, up to this modern age, including many dilemmas that we face today, including some health issues and how we can turn that around and how we can make our body strong and possibly live all the way till 200. Future Esoteric is book two, and Future Esoteric takes a decidedly forward-looking view into many of the issues facing the world. And each chapter in both books are subjects. So, for example, there's a chapter in Future Esoteric called Underground. And obviously, it just covers underground bases. And the third book, which is not out yet, is called Beyond Esoteric, The Ultimate Journey. I got about 18 more months to work on this and get it out. So it's a 2018 release is what it's looking like now.
And what does that look? What is that about, that one?
So I never repeat any material. And I realize there's still a few loose ends, both in the UFO narrative that I want to include and some other things that have to do with the creeping fascism into our, as well as taking on the transhumanist agenda, which is very complex, and it's going to be in a section called the Uber Mind. So it's Humans 2.0, we evolve to the next level, and how we're doing it to ourselves, how this is mainly driven through science and genetic manipulation. So I just think that people have a right to know. This has always been my mode of operandi, is that I really feel like these are subjects that are extremely important, and intellectual people who see that the world around us is imperfect and what can be done, I think these books will be a great aid to those seekers.
Are these published by you? Are you self-publishing these? Or?
So I had a publishing business for 20 years called CCC Publishing. It's also the name of the website. And in those 20 years, I've done most of my books, not all. I've published through other author or through other publishers. Just do them through CCC Publishing myself. But I have half a dozen authors who have done titles through CCC Publishing, including Leo Lyons Agami, which is a 5-book deal. We're about halfway through his book. And then when his final book comes out, called The Invisible Master, in 2017, I'll have a free and clear path to come out with Beyond Esoteric. So the answer is, I started out self-publishing, and I do publish other authors. It's grown to be more like a small or even mid-sized publisher now, and we're distributed through IPG, so the books are in all the chain bookstores and independent bookstores, and even internationally available. So it's really through the distribution with IPG, Independent Publishers Group, that I've had a great success in getting these books out to the world.
Well, let's go back to the UFO stuff. So you started to talk a little bit about your experience, and then we'll get more into the book. So tell me about your experience. I love hearing people's experiences because they're all so unique, and it makes it real. It makes it real.
Yeah, totally. And I described this at the in the front matter of Future Esoteric, that in 1997, I was backpacking around the Pacific Northwest with a couple friends, and we were up at Crater Lake on the just north of the California border in Oregon. Beautiful, incredible, crystal clear, blue, clear crater with a deep blue lake, azure blue, and purest water in North America, because it's just rainwater that comes in. Mm. We're up there watching a beautiful sunset near the highest peak, which is just under 9,000 feet. And it was still quite bright out, daylight, even though the sun had just set. And we started walking up to this campsite we set up at the highest part of the mountain. And just out of nowhere, this very bright white light, perfect line, like a slow-moving laser beam, but there was no start and no finish. It just progressed along this white streak in the sky, and it was, the trajectory was right into the lake. And before it, the light beam actually hit the lake, it started breaking up into blips, like perfectly square blips. Dot, 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 dot. And then we couldn't see it anymore. It was so incredible. Myself and two friends I was with, we fell to the ground laughing and instantly described what we had seen with each other. There were a few others in our group, and we rushed up the hill to catch up with them to see if they had seen it. Unfortunately, they had entered the woods and did not see it. Right before we entered the woods, myself and these two other guys I was with, we saw the exact same phenomenon occur over Mount Shasta, about 35 or 40 miles to the south. Exact same phenomenon, 10 seconds, bright white light entering the mountain itself. But, you know, the light stopped before it actually got to the mountain. Of course, there was no impact or anything, but it was light phenomenon. And so I was very, very interested. What exactly was this that I saw?
What year was that?
97. So it was pre-internet. Couldn't really go online and try to look it up.
Right.
But it just instilled in me that I know what I saw, and there's no explanation, there's no official explanation of what I saw, and it just got me on this trajectory to try to learn, first of all, what it was, and then second of all, how it opened up
this world, sometimes strange world of UFO research. And what I did find subsequently is that most UFO sightings occur near volcanoes. And that's kind of odd. Like, what would it be about volcanoes? Well, they're giant underground cavities to begin with. And while they may be super hot, they would be able to contain a large ship. And, of course, if they're able to transition through matter, say the mountainside of Mount Shasta or the water of Crater Lake, and get to these giant chambers, then maybe heat is not a factor at all. And it's a way that they can cloak themselves or stay hidden out of the public eye by us surface dwellers.
Wow. So you saw the same thing twice, huh? Once over Crater Lake and once over Mount Shasta. That is very strange. To see it once, it's strange, but...
Yeah, and to see it twice, then totally confirmed in my mind and the guys I was with, and we talked about it all night, that this is very much real. And just to finish on the Mount Shasta part, I have friends that live up there. I live in San Francisco, and I've been up there a few times and hiked to the summit of Mount Shasta. And these friends of mine tell me, we see phenomenon here all the time. That it's just not even really a big deal anymore because it happens so much.
Right.
So there's something definitely going on up there.
I was camping out up at the top... at the top of the parking lots there, Panther Meadows there once. And I was in a tent with my girlfriend, and she started to have a nightmare. Like she was being pulled out of her body. It wasn't anything visual, but it was sort of psychic. She was freaking out. Something was going on there that she thought was really weird. I mean, I didn't see anything, but... something strange was going on for sure. But do you think, so these two instances that happened, do you think that somehow, I know it's getting off the top of your book, but I think it's really interesting, that it was directed towards you and your friends? Do you think it was a conscious contact in a way?
I don't think so. I think it was just something that was occurring, because then we saw it again 50 miles away. And I mean, if they wanted to be really in our face, maybe they would have come again at Crater Lake. It seemed to me this was my thought at the time, and I still feel this way, that it was something interdimensional, that it was something beyond our realm of perception, but maybe what we saw was a heat signature. Maybe a fourth dimensional craft coming in, or maybe just something of pure light of a higher dimensional nature. It's still inexplicable, but it was a perfectly clear, bright, white light streaking through the sky. I think anybody who happened to be looking up at the sky that day at that moment would have seen it as well. Because certainly these guys saw it, and I didn't really take them for spiritual... seekers in any way, and at that time I wasn't really myself either. But I know what I saw, and I recall it to this very day as clearly as I did back then.
Well, you know that phrase, "I know what I saw." James, what's his name? James Fox, I think, actually made a movie about people who've seen UFOs and the lights over Phoenix with the title "I Know What I Saw," and you know, it's a lot of people trying to tell. Witnesses that they didn't see what they actually did see. And, you know, I think we have to trust people's judgments and awareness that they do know what they might not know what it is. Like, you might not know what you saw, but you know, that you saw something for sure.
Right. Yeah, I know James Fox. He lives up here in the Bay Area too, and that's a great documentary. Exactly right. And how can you tell people, oh, well, you didn't see this. What you saw is just swamp gas, or all the excuses they've used to discount sightings. Well, those cover-ups don't work anymore. And the people who have had genuine sightings, they know what they saw. I think the only real question nowadays, Alan, is it one of ours or is it one of theirs? Because some of the chapters in Future Esoteric, I cover the government being involved in backward engineering and working on these crafts and creating what is now a secret space program that is completely out of the purview of the American public. and has led to what Richard Dolan describes a breakaway civilization. Those are humans that now live in outer space on some of these space stations and ships that have been created that are mostly in our solar system, but not necessarily coming down to Earth all the time.
Do you think they're really... I mean, I like Richard Dolan's. He's a great guy, great researcher, but there's no proof of that breakaway civilization. It's just a theory, isn't it?
Well, I think it goes beyond theory, because, of course, he had this... the hacker in the UK who got into the servers at the Johnson Space Center in Alabama. It's called Building 6. And he was able to see logs, Excel spreadsheets of the transfer of equipment, of personnel, of the ship names, which had the name USSS. There was an additional S on there, and it was the Hillenpocker and the USSS LeMay were the name of these giant cigar-shaped ships. He even got to the point of looking at images, and now this also was in the late 90s when most people had dial-up, very slow speed connections, and this gentleman had... was halfway uploading an image of one of these cigar-shaped ships. His name is Gary McKinnon. And he got to the point where he was about halfway uploaded with this image when basically they found out he was snooping on them and cut him off. He was subsequently arrested, and for about a decade they tried to extradite him to the USA. And there was a big... movement and campaign not to do that, and they finally called off the dogs just about a year or two ago to extradite Gary McKinnon to the U.S. And you know, he would have been like Bradley Manning, just tried and thrown into a cage. So he luckily got off that hook, but it wasn't before major recording artists such as David Gilmour of Pink Floyd and several others made some records and created quite a lot of attention to avoid his extradition. He's just one example. There are other examples of the breakaway civilization, such as you mentioned, the giant sighting in Phoenix, the Phoenix Lights, which was a triangular craft. My good friend David Hatcher Childress, he lives in Camp Verde near Sedona. He did not see it, but he has friends that were up there near Flagstaff and in Sedona who did see the Phoenix Lights, which basically went slowly over Phoenix, went all the way up to Sedona and Flagstaff, then it made a sharp left turn. There were witnesses that saw it and went right into the southwestern corner of Nevada, and that is where Area 51 is. So it leads me to believe that the only question is it ours or theirs, that the Phoenix Lights was very much ours. And this triangular craft is a backward engineered free energy, anti-gravity craft that has been engineered and used by our scientists and this breakaway civilization that Dolan talks about.
Right. So what else do you get into in the future esoterica? I mean, yes, the ETs are here. Why are they here? I have my own theories about why they're here. And what should we do about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I draw a distinction in future esoteric that there are two types of extraterrestrials. And I don't want people to get caught up in the idea that some have scaly skin or big eyes or some look remarkably similar to us. There are many, many, many species. But what's important between the two distinctions is whether they're service to self or service to others. Mm. The ones who are service to self appear to be the ones who have been here for a long time, that have been responsible for the abductions, that may even be some of our folklore stories about making a pact with the devil or Satan himself or Lucifer, which I believe are the Draco reptilians. This is the conclusion of Future Esoteric. Whereas the service to self ETs, or I'm sorry, the service to other ETs, the benevolent ETs, the ones that don't show themselves, that may only be operating behind the scenes, they're the ones we would like to be aligned with in a future date. And this is pretty much how the Utopia section closes out. That if we were able to get the human civilization on track to stop wars and stop damaging the planet, maybe we could still have some kind of meaningful relationship with these benevolent ETs.
Wait, so you're saying there's two types that show up pretty much, the ones that are here to harvest us and the ones that are here to help us. But the ones that are here to help us, are they, doesn't seem like they're doing that much. We still have a lot of problems.
Well, correct, but just recall that in the Star Trek series, they have what's called the Prime Directive. Yeah. And my understanding is this is a real law of the universe, that you're not supposed to directly influence the evolution of a lesser species that is still growing up, as the human race very much is. You're only meant to interact if they're about to destroy themselves. And that's why they're the good benevolent ETs have been spotted flying over missile silos and even deactivating nuclear missiles and doing things like that, just to say, we're not going to allow you to have a thermonuclear war and destroy this planet. It's just not going to be allowed. And apparently they have stopped this on several occasions, whereas the service to self ETs would kind of like to see us self-destruct and maybe have a drastic population reduction, because there's so many of us now, and we're starting to wake up to their agenda as well, and that their cover of darkness, their cover of secrecy is now being revealed. And this is what they fear the most, is when the human population wakes up, then we can finally, hopefully, eject them from this planet.
Wait, but that whole Prime Directive thing, of course I've heard it over and over again, but it doesn't seem to be true. I mean, look at the Anunnaki, if you believe them. They came here, they totally interfered with our population. They ejected their genetics into us and evolved a whole new race of beings, you know?
Right.
What do you,
I agree.
So where does that relate to the Prime Directive?
Well, what if they consider themselves indigenous to planet Earth? What if they've been living underground for thousands of years and say, hey, we're as much of an Earthling as those surface dwellers are? Then that's their workaround. That's how they can say to the Galactic Federation or whatever governing body would enforce such things like the Prime Directive, they can say, hey, we have just as much right to be here as the surface dwellers. Just because they're 7 billion and maybe we're only a few thousand doesn't discount our birthright to be here. But the problem is the Anunnaki, aka, which I think are the Draco reptilians, may actually have these powers over us that are much stronger than we can handle, such as being telepathic or having the technology to fly throughout the universe. We can't compete with that. So therefore we're disadvantaged, and that's why it's my understanding, and some people I've talked to in the UFO industry support this view, that the benevolent ETs are working on behalf of the human race behind the scenes. This is a conversation I had with Alex Collier, and he also speaks about this in his videos. The Andromedians are leading this charge to extract the reptilians off of planet Earth, because we are disadvantaged, and just putting them somewhere else, not judging them, not putting them on trial, not hurting them even, just saying, you have to leave Earth, we're going to put you way out here, mm-hmm. So don't come back. And by doing that, perhaps we're clearing this Archon network of the main protagonists, which are the Draco ETs, which basically control the Greys, which are all synthetic beings, by the way. None of the Greys are born as we know it. They're all test tube. They're all synthetic. But they also have telepathic abilities and other what we would view as superhuman abilities. And that's how they're able to have such control over us in the event we're abducted.
Well, yeah, no, but the breakaway civilization, which I do think exists, aren't they very connected to the reptilian agendas?
Well, they are indeed. And this goes pretty deep. This goes into some of the occultism that my author Leon Lyons-Agami gets into very deeply, including Aleister Crowley, because you have to remember, British intelligence, where it all started, way back in the Elizabethan era. Okay, this is back when William Shakespeare was writing his plays and Queen Elizabeth I was on the throne. She employed John Dee, mm-hmm. who is the original 007. Okay, that was his little moniker and signature, you know, James Bond.
Oh, really?
Character ripped that off. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was the one that came up with the crystal ball. He's the one that could intercede and talk to entities, dark entities, and they would work on behalf of John Dee and the Crown. And this is what many people think, and Leo Zagami makes a very good case of in his book Confessions of an Illuminati, that they were able to thwart the Spanish invasion of Britain. Because John Dee told Queen Elizabeth, don't attack them. Just let them sit offshore. Give it another day. Give it another day. Sure enough, a huge storm came on the third or fourth day, wiped out the Armada. Britain was never invaded, and they were greatly overwhelmed and outnumbered. So ever since then, in the underground chambers, let's call it that, of the CIA, which formed later, which formed out of German intelligence, by the way, from the Third Reich, paperclip Nazis that came over here, but more specifically, MI5, who Aleister Crowley was a double agent for, but was in support of the Crown, although the Nazis thought they were on his side. He was the classic double agent. He was very much into this, summoning these dark energy forces, which I think now we can see as the Archon Network. And after the U.S. became the world power post-World War II, and the CIA started getting a lot of these secrets, this dark network came over to our side. And so your question about the secret space program being allied with the Draco and the malevolent ETs, I think is absolutely correct, and they have been. But this is also they're going to be their shortcoming and their undoing, because they're not of a Buddha nature. And according to Nexus Magazine, this article I was reading, that the problem with our secret space program right now, they have backward engineered the technology, they have it, but all of the astronauts, who basically, David Childress told me this, come out of the submarine core, because they're already working in confined environments, pressurized environments, so they're well suited to go from submarine to spacecraft. None of them, because they're all trained in basic training, learning how to kill and shoot, they're all these jarheads in the military, especially these high-level pilots. And they're not of a Buddha nature. So they get these craft up to near the speed of light, is my understanding of how interdimensional travel works. And basically, humans become their light bodies. And because these guys have been trained to kill and shoot and create warfare, they're not of a Buddha nature. So they get up to those conditions, boom, they just have to come right back down. So until humans, and part of the problem is that there has not been this disclosure or the truth on the matter, until we as a human race understand what the space program is all about and take away the secrecy from it, can we hope to join these benevolent ETs in some kind of meaningful relationship. And then perhaps the Star Trek future will come true in 250 years.
Right. So, okay, so who is removing these archonic beings? I mean, which race is doing that? And how do we know that's happening? I mean, where are we hearing this from?
Well, I'm hearing it from Alex Collier.
And where's he getting it from?
And he basically gets transmissions telepathically through the Andromedians. And apparently they are the ones who are fighting the strongest on behalf of Earth through these galactic councils and federations to support Earth in a very non-confrontational way. They're supporting us, but behind the scenes. So it's my understanding through him and some other people I've spoken to that the grays are being extracted. David Wilcock talks about this too. They're being beamed out of these underground bases so they can't meddle with humans anymore. And then the agreement is we get the physical grays and most of the reptilians out of here, which my understanding is the case right now. And then let's see if the humans can really live up to our responsibilities of stopping war and saving this planet. So that's the great show that's being conducted right here on Earth right now. And it's also my understanding that there are many, many races watching us, just watching us, not intervening in any way, but just keeping an eye because this is a very unique situation we find ourselves in right now that if we're allowed to evolve on our own without any interference from fourth dimensional beings who want to keep us in an enslaved state. If we are able to evolve, this is very unique in the universe that it happens very rarely or perhaps never at all. So there's a lot of attention on Earth right now. And there's a lot of attention as far as who is going to make this happen. Who is going to be the world leader that basically makes disclosure? That could very well happen in the next few years. I don't think it'll come from the United States. Probably come from someone like Putin or maybe China or Japan, some kind of official declaration of UFO ET disclosure. But I think we're just so intertied into the secret space program and everything else that it won't come from us.
As far as like the grays, you were saying, what about their breeding program, their hybridization of human ETs? I mean,
That's a great question, Alan. And this is where it goes down the rabbit hole, probably the deepest. And there's an incredible series of videos on YouTube by this guy named, Buresh, Buresh. Have you ever heard of him? What was his first name?
Barish? Is that the guy?
Yeah, Barish.
Dan Barish.
Okay.
Oh, yeah,
Watch his videos because this guy had worked in some of those underground bases where they were doing some of these hybridization programs. And some of the things he said were that the grays, especially the tall grays, are actually the future humans coming back in time to ensure that on this timeline, they will exist. And that's why the hybridization program has to go forward for their own very existence. So basically, there are two timelines. There's timeline one and timeline two. Timeline one is basically we wake up to the oppression. The criminals get arrested, we avert World War III, we save the planet, we come into contact with benevolent ETs, and we reach the golden age. And this is what is meant to happen. But of course, there are a lot of criminals that want to take us into World War III, that don't care about the welfare of the planet, that have their underground bases and their bunkers that could survive anything and stocked up for decades or perhaps even longer with their hydroponic grow rooms and vast underground cities like underneath the Denver airport. And that is where these hybrid gray / humans are being created as we speak right now. Under the Arcoleta Mesa at Dulce, New Mexico, is the largest laboratory for creating them.
Is that still going on?
Apparently it is. So when they're extracting the grays, they're getting them from, and the reptilians, they're getting them from around the world. So far, the U.S. hasn't given in because we're allied with them. Why would we want to let the Andromedans or other benevolent ETs extract them from Dulce and elsewhere when we're allowing them to be here? When we have created this Griotta Treaty, which goes back decades, in my opinion, totally not valid because it wasn't known by the people. So, therefore, if it's not valid, it doesn't hold any sort of authority.
Right, but you're saying that the ETs are doing the hybridization to ensure the future, and so that's a good thing, though.
Well, it's a good thing for them, certainly.
Well, for us, too. It's our future, isn't it?
Well, you know, our future is going to split, and this is according to Dan Burish. There will be a point where some humans take refuge underground, and that some humans will stay on the surface. Those humans on the surface will still continue to look very much like us, but they will go through this human 2.0 transhumanism. And we're talking about more than decades or lifetimes or generations. We're talking about hundreds of years, thousands of years. And that's where these tall grays come from, that they are the hybridization mix between humans and these synthetic grays. They stay underground. Eventually, they leave the planet. They go somewhere else, but then they come back here. And so it's really a strange paradox to talk about time travel and other species coming back here affecting the timeline. But this is exactly how it appears. And this also includes Duncan and Cameron, who jumped off of the ship.
I mean, I know Duncan. I'm not sure. Yeah. Have you met him? I'm not sure what to make of his story because he, of course, then says he's the reincarnation of the guy who jumped off the ship at in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia experiment. So it gets very strange.
It does.
And let's just keep it basic in a sense because, look, sure, there are ETs visiting the planet. I don't think anyone can deny that, right? I mean, that's for sure. You've seen them. I've seen ships. Probably 75% of the people who will be at contact in the desert has had some kind of experience. We are being interacted with other civilizations. It's here. Have you been up to James Gilliland's place? Have you seen?
I have had an invite to go up there 2 summers ago, the East SETI Ranch.
Yes,
would love to. Have you been?
No, I would love to also, so I might do that. But, you know, we are being interfaced with the galaxies that are around us, the life forms that are around us. I think basically we just have to wake up to the fact that we're not alone. So I know all this other stuff is possible and it's true, the reptilians, I'm not denying that. I'm just saying, what do we do with it? How do we prepare for it? What's your suggestion? How do we deal with it all?
That's a great question, and it is very perplexing when you look at all the sides of it. And I was on the set of Ancient Aliens for season 9. Dr. Sala was on after me, and we got to have lunch together, and we talked about it. And he's like the father of exopolitics, which is examining the politics of the universe and how ETs interact with Earth and what their motives are and so forth. And we both feel that really what has to happen is a mass awakening of humanity. People just have to wake up to this fact, just the very simple fact, what you just said, that it's very clear that we have contact from extraterrestrials, and what does it all mean? Well, that's a bigger question, but just the simple fact of accepting the idea that indeed humans have been contacted, the Earth is being monitored very closely, and somehow we're going to have to force some kind of disclosure where we can have an open and honest discussion about what this all means. And it all starts with us. It all starts with each individual waking up to this kind of reality.
Right. So I think that's why we're gathering in the desert, to show we can find that support in numbers, in a kind of mass movement. But so what would you think the scenario for disclosure should be? How do you see that unfolding?
Well, it's pretty clear that all the advanced economy nations on this planet have something to do with some kind of space program, or at least aspire to it.
Well, how do you get? What do you mean by, like, where are you getting that from? I mean, I'm just curious.
Oh, well, it's very clear with China, Russia, USA, Japan has put rocket satellites in space. I'm just talking in a very basic sense that the advanced economies on Earth all have something to do with outer space, whether it's just putting satellites in orbit or bringing one of their astronauts up to the space station, the International Space Station. But going beyond that, all these nations also aspire to have the kind of hardware and the crafts that can at least navigate our solar system, but perhaps go beyond. So when you look at the acquisition of technology, and I cover this in Future Esoteric in the chapter called Backward Engineering, that these crafts have been basically crashed and recovered since the 1930s. The Nazis were big time into it. They had a very famous crash in the Black Forest. Mussolini allowed them to inspect a craft that came down in Italy, which they took back to Germany, and worked at backward engineering. Well, after World War II, I mentioned earlier, the top scientists that the U.S. could acquire came here under Project Paperclip. Some of those rocket scientists went to Russia and worked on their space program. That's how they got Sputnik up before we did, and Yuri, the astronaut, before we did. They were assisted by the Germans, too. Well, if you ask the Germans themselves, this guy, Hermann Oberecht, who was one of our paperclip Nazis, he said, well, we've been helped. And they said, helped by who? And he said, helped by the people from up there. So it's very clear that the Nazis, as well as NASA, which is never a straight answer, and you're not going to get this out of them, but it's very clear to any researcher who's looked into it, knows that there's really two sides of NASA, that there's also the space program that's run by the Air Force and Navy intelligence, which in many ways duplicates the same efforts, but they have to do it that way to keep one segment of it completely secret. And how come the U.S., after the space shuttle program, does not have any kind of known craft that goes into outer space anymore? Do we just blew it off because it's too much money?
Yeah. What do you make about that? How come?
Well, because there is the secret space program, and they're not willing to admit it yet. But this is where all these trillions that Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11, announced $2.3 trillion, and they just did it again last year, to the tune of what was it, eight point something trillion, just gone missing. Yeah, don't know where it went. Just, you know, evaporated. Trillions of dollars? Can't track it down? I mean, this is crazy. Where does this money go? If you understand the secret space program and some of these underground bases, how expensive they are to create, that's where the money went.
So it seems like it's all coming to a head, doesn't it?
Very, very much so. And maybe coming to a head also means that this fake fiat currency being backed by foreign governments, they're getting hip to it, and they don't want to do it. So now we're faced with a new alliance. When we were kids, it was the Cold War, right? It was always the Russians or the Chinese out to get us. Well, they have reformed into what's called the BRICS.
What's
which
that?
Is an acronym for Brazil, India, China, Russia, and South Africa.
Those are countries that want what?
Well, that have created a new alliance, the BRICS alliance.
Oh, I didn't know
and
that. Okay.
So yeah, and they're then they've just started a new bank that's going to counter the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Shanghai, China, called the AIIB. And when this bank comes fully online, it was just announced a little over a year ago. It's just in the very early formation. But when it fully comes online, it's going to introduce a new currency, probably a new Chinese yuan, which is a currency of China, based on gold. And what this means is no fiat currency based on nothing, like our Federal Reserve notes here in the USA, can compete with that. You can't compete with gold if you're just this make-believe, we want everybody to believe that the dollar is the petrodollar or the world currency. It's going to flip-flop real quick. And when that happens, there's going to be a day of reckoning in our financial markets and our financial lives here in America. So again, I think if the day we hear that there are mass arrests of George Soros and Kissinger, the Bush family, the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, that would be the greatest day in the history of modern civilization.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I sure hope so. And that will happen if there is a mass awakening. Because these guys are criminals of the highest standard and level. And if we can get rid of them, then we can totally reformulate, for one, the money system, but also to release free energy technology. And I have a chapter in Future Esoteric all about all the free energy patents and machines that have been brought out ever since Tesla, who they squashed like a bug because he wouldn't go along with it.
Do you think Bernie Sanders could help bring that new economy about?
Of course. He's probably the only candidate that could do that. But he's not establishment. So that scares them. He doesn't go along with the standard line, nor does Trump. Now, we don't know where Trump stands. You know, he's never held public office, so we have no idea what his voting record is because it's non-existent. And only two presidents in the history of America never had a position as an elected official.
Oh, yeah.
But they did have a long history as career military men, and that's Zachary Taylor and Dwight D. Eisenhower were the only two presidents who never held public office. Well, Trump doesn't even have a military record, so we really don't know where he stands.
I don't think he could. I mean, it seems like, I don't know, that would be a nightmare, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Maybe the Antichrist, who the heck knows?
Maybe it is. But anyway, getting back to this topic at hand, because I think you bring up a lot of really key points, is that isn't it possible, though, that the ETs and sightings are increased around the world, you know, that they will just start to show themselves more and more as we get used to the idea that we are being visited?
Right. And that may be how the prime directive can be the workaround. Shall we say that if they're here enough times, maybe not landing on the White House lawn, because that's what everybody says, well, why don't they just show themselves? But maybe if they do keep doing these subtle shows of themselves, and now with everybody holding a camera on their smartphones, can film them, maybe this will be the trigger that basically brings one government, maybe Brazil or like a lesser country than Russia or China or Japan to come forward. But, you know, they've already started doing this in the form of releasing their top secret documents. And to a degree, the U.S. has also started doing this. I think the reason why the FBI did it, the CIA did it, the NSA did it. They call it the vault, where they're just releasing these documents, many of them with black lines through them so you can't read the whole thing, but with photos too, that when finally the day comes and there is some kind of world disclosure, these agencies, these alphabet agencies, say, hey, well, you know, we put up the vault way back in 2008, and we were trying to disclose, but, you know, some people didn't pay attention. So I think it's a way of covering their own tracks, so they're still able to be relevant.
Yeah, no, but the other possibility is that disclosure is actually happening as we speak. It's a slow leaking disclosure.
That's true. And so this would correspond with them coming out with documents, as well as other countries of the world, which are doing it in a much more forward way, which are like Brazil, for example, or Belgium did it about 5-6 years ago, and even the UK. But they're doing it in a way that they're having a press conference and alerting it to their countrymen. But our alphabet agencies, when they put these sites up, they just appeared one day, and then you hear on social media, hey, check this out. The NSA is now putting up UFO documents. So they're not doing it in a very outward kind of public way that some of these other countries are doing it.
Hmm. Well, you know, some people say, you know, Richard Hastings, that guy, he was a military guy.
Uh-huh.
He did one of these press conferences at the National Press Club. He says maybe when we finally accept the fact that they are here, because they've come and gone over the last 100 years, it really won't be a big deal. I think that when the government finally, everyone will say, well, of course, we told you so. And it's like that integration. Of course, there's still the people have been hiding it, that and of course, the technologies, and someone has to be held responsible for that. And it seems like even, well, that's one thing. But Obama's part of this leak. Did you see him on the Ellen DeGeneres show last week or a couple of weeks ago? Talking to that little girl?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And I think he would like to maybe even be known as the disclosure president. And maybe he still will at the very end. But I, as I point out in the secret section of Future Esoteric, the reason they don't, and this was brought on by way back in when Art Bell was on Coast to Coast, he had John Lear on the show. And it's even called the John Lear test. And it's basically, John Lear said, he's privy, CIA, he's been in the biz a long time, and come out with quite a few disclosures himself. But he said, look, if you were the president, and he's talking to Art Bell, and if you were going to make a disclosure that would basically rock the world, that would embroil your administration, not only for weeks, but maybe months and even years, trying to explain why the U.S. government held this up for so long, he said, would you do it? And Art Bell said, no, I wouldn't do it, considering what it would take and how it would just sideline all the other things that president was trying to do. So maybe Obama's only opportunity to do it, if this guy is really genuine and really does feel like this is important for the human race, will be in the next last few months of his administration.
Yeah, but it seems like his agendas are already being sidelined in a way. And then there's the Hillary Clinton outburst with the John Podesta saying, yeah, we want to get to the bottom of this. So what do you make about those statements?
But just keep in mind, I think it's great, but just keep in mind that Hillary's statement and Obama's statement recently are only because they were prompted to make some kind of reply. And it's great that they made an affirmative reply that they would like to get to the bottom of it, or that they want to see it happen. Well, look, you're the president. If anybody can make it happen, it's you. But apparently they're not even privy to all the access to some of these programs that they don't even have the authorization to go in this deep. So really the only thing a president could do, and really only at the end of his or her administration, is make some kind of disclosure statement public right towards the end of when they have any kind of influence.
But that doesn't make sense, that even the president doesn't have access. I don't know how that could be possible under the Constitution.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things that don't make sense under the Constitution. But yeah, Stephen Greer, through the Disclosure Project and many of the government witnesses that he's had, have said they know that the president can't get access. Bill Clinton tried to get access, and he was denied. Jimmy Carter even said when he was a candidate running for president that he would like to get to the bottom of it. And indeed, Carter himself had a UFO sighting. And yeah, when the time came to it, he was briefed. Carter was briefed. They probably said, you're not going to say a word because this is national security and we're keeping it locked down. And Carter never said a word.
Wait, but then there's the Eisenhower, if you believe that Richard Dolan investigation, where Eisenhower says to the CIA or somebody, I'm going to find out what's happening at Area 51. If you don't tell me, I'm going to invade with the army.
And, but that never happened.
Because they did find out. There's that video where the guy talks about going to Area 51 on behalf of Eisenhower and discovering the alien crafts and the aliens and going back and filling Eisenhower in on it.
Right, and then making him decide that, I guess invasion is probably not the best option. Maybe we need to explore this a little bit. But the problem with Eisenhower is he was greatly influenced by the Rockefellers, who were acting as his counsel, especially Nelson Rockefeller, who basically encouraged him to accept some of these groups like the Council on Foreign Relations to set the policy. This is where Eisenhower went awry. And apparently he even had face-to-face meetings with these ETs. And, of course, they were the bad ones and said, look, we'll give you technology if you just let us continue our operations here on Earth in a clandestine way, just turn the other way. And so they set an agreement that, okay, you can do abductions, but they have to be on a limited basis, and you have to tell us the names of the people you took. And, of course, they didn't and continued on with that. And then Eisenhower, in his final years, felt completely betrayed. And just like the way that he gave that military-industrial complex talk at the very end of his two-term presidency. It's the only time meaningful disclosure about the mechanizations of the secret government and how the military-industrial complex was going to take over could occur.
But, yeah. So, but you think Nelson Rockefeller knew about the ET presence?
He did.
Then why was Lawrence Rockefeller, I guess Nelson's brother, still trying to find ways of bringing that out to the public? He never was able to.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, though, if that's genuine.
Really?
Only because, well, his brother, the other Rockefeller, Jay Rockefeller, who is the senator at West Virginia, he came out and said, we should have never let the internet open up. We should have always kept it bottled up in the cause of national security. So you kind of get these mixed messages out of the Rockefeller family. Some say that we should have ET disclosure. Others say, we don't like the internet. It's exposing us way too much. Shut it down or take it back. I think now the genie's out of the bottle and you really can't take it back. But it's very telling that they have regrets about letting the internet open up the way it did.
Really? Well, I know they're a pretty strange bunch of people for sure. But I don't know. I think we're here to evolve. It's hard to know. I'm not sure if Nelson Rockefeller knew about the ETs, because I do think Lawrence Rockefeller was sincere. He gave a lot of money to John Mack. He held meetings. that Linda Moulton Howe was at, and Stephen Greer, a bunch of people. I think Lawrence Rockefeller really tried to get to the bottom of the ET thing. That's why he was petitioning Hillary and Bill Clinton to open up the files, and I think he wasn't able to do it. So I don't know, and I mean, who knows for sure? I mean, somebody knows, but not us. But hopefully it will all come out. I would say 20 years. I think that's the time frame we have for a real public disclosure. Or it'll just sort of start to disappear, and the breakaway civilization will have broken away. The planet will become enslaved. The economies will collapse. Or we have a possible great future where, the economic structures break down. There's a free and open exchange of ideas, possibilities, technologies, getting off of fossil fuels and living into a new reality, I would say. So,
a utopia.
Yeah, is that what your last book's about?
The last section in Future Esoteric is called the Utopia section.
Well, let's talk about that.
You just outlined.
Well, tell me what you make of it, though. How do you see it happening?
Well, pretty much how you just defined it. I'll just read off the chapters in Utopia, and they're very telling in just their title. First is Utopia, just examining other views of how people in the past have thought it could be. The Age of Transparency, when we come to the point where there are no more secrets, if you can imagine that, if that's even possible. But it seems to move forward, we have to be able to know everything that's happened in our past, to end the secrecy state, and then we can start evolving as humans. And one of those ways is developing superhuman abilities. When I traveled through India, I read the book Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, and each chapter was another yogi that had achieved some incredible superhuman ability. And I think it's innate within all of us, and that this is something that can be achieved.
Well, what do you mean? Can you be a little more specific when you say superhuman?
Oh, sure. So basically, for example, telepathy. Speaking to one another, just using our minds, not even moving our lips. And this is how ETs communicate amongst themselves. Other examples of superhuman ability, telekinesis, bending a spoon with your mind, moving objects. Other examples are astral traveling, leaving your body at will, and being able to consciously navigate not only around the world or the solar system, but across the timeline, looking back uncritically at any event that's ever occurred on this planet, even on other planets. So if these are the kind of things that we really want, and these are the kind of things that it appears the extraterrestrials who look very much like us have achieved, this is... Talk about a breakthrough. Talk about re-educating ourselves to these different superhuman abilities that could greatly change the makeup of the human being. Another example is our pineal gland, which in almost all human beings is closed. If we are able to open the pineal gland and get past all the roadblocks that keep it shut down, this will, just by default, make us multidimensional beings on this planet. And then these superhuman abilities will just come very much innately, come right out, because they've always been there. They've just been shut down.
I mean, I totally believe in telepathy. I have been telepathic. I have. But the other stuff, I don't know. Have you seen demonstrations of some of this other stuff?
Well, of course, there's Uri Geller, who went around and demonstrated to Lars.
I did see Uri Geller. I have to say, he picked a spoon up off a table, and he ran his finger over it, and it was like butter, just like bent over, bent in half. I saw him pick up a seed in his hand, a mustard seed, said grow, and I saw the seed sprout out of his fingertips. So, yes.
And this is what I mean. These are just examples of a few individuals who have these incredible abilities. Ingo Swann, who was instrumental first with helping the U.S. military do remote viewing. It was originally used to go spy on the Russians, go into their...
Yeah, he coined the term remote viewing.
He sure did. He just passed away a few years ago.
I knew Ingo. He lives right around the corner from me, Ingo.
Actually. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he lives like three blocks from... His house is still there. He owned a big house there, a three-story apartment building on the Bowery.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But anyway, Ingo had some pretty amazing abilities. He was also very human in a way, too. So, I mean, it takes like... This is what the ancient mystery schools were about. Do you know about them?
Absolutely. Cover them in modern esoteric.
Oh, you do? Because that's training the initiate to be the superhuman being.
Absolutely. And why can't we get back to that? That's my whole point.
Why can't we
use the example of Uri Geller or Ingo Swann or other people from Autobiography of a Yogi to teach us? Why don't we have a new curriculum that really makes us into these superhumans? You don't see that. So this is an example of how we can achieve utopia. And this is a personal evolution, too, on steroids. I mean, just going above and beyond anything we ever thought was even possible.
So what do you think, then, the future? I mean, where are we going with it? I mean, I know we have a couple of possibilities, but what do you think is most likely?
Well, I think timeline one, which is we will achieve the golden age, that we will go forward. Time is kind of like a river, and a river flows at a course that's pretty much set. You can always divert a river. You can chop through rock and create a little offshoot stream, but it's very difficult to change the course of the river. And the river right now is timeline one. They're trying to chop a channel and create timeline two and provoke World War III and try to keep a lid on people really learning about exopolitics and what it really means to have ETs interacting with Earth. But it's only really diversionary tactics that we will achieve the golden age. I just hope it can happen within our lifetimes, Alan, so we can actually be vindicated, for one, for all the things that we've said for all these years, and two, and more importantly, just to see the human race achieve its ideals and its potential to become super human in many ways, and to achieve these kind of superhuman abilities I was just explaining. It is within the realm of possibility, just like achieving the golden age is within the realm of possibility. And the more of us who put our mind into seeing that future and visualizing it, the closer we're going to get.
Right. Well, what kind of stuff are you going to talk about at Contact?
So I have a new lecture series that incorporates many of the things we just talked about today, but it's called Everything is Fake. And it goes into all the subject matters that have been totally distorted and turned around to make us live in this reality that is somewhat nonsensical in some ways, but also that basically has created this false reality. And I'm going to start the talk with this quote from William Casey, who was the CIA director under Ronald Reagan. And at their first staff meeting in 1981, he made this dubious claim that we'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. And that's the point we've gotten to, that so many things in our world are just fake. The mass media is fake. The sky is fake with chemtrails. The food with GMOs. The water with fluoride. Our history is fake. Everything. I mean, you just go on and on and on. So I'm going to do this talk, which has already been well received on Jimmy Church's Fade to Black and a couple of radio spots I've done this week. This is my fourth interview this week.
Oh, great. Well,
and so it's just rolling now, and everybody says, oh, man, you nailed it. That's exactly how things are. So well, I'm going to work on this until contact, but that will be my first public presentation of this alternative narrative, all these subjects that have been withheld from us. So I hope you'll be at my talk. But we'll definitely have a chance to hang out and meet again this June. And all your listeners, hope you come out to Contact in the Desert and hear my presentation there.
All right, sorry. How do we... Okay, I agree everything is fake, but how do we eventually tear down the walls, tear down the fake walls?
Well, once again, how do we individually bring forth a disclosure? And that is by educating ourselves, by knowing the difference between what is fake reality and what is a real reality. And this is really up to us as the individuals to take this on. Use our discernment, ability of critical thinking to separate the wheat from the chaff. And this is kind of a new concept that we have been duped in such a way, as William Casey said 35 years ago. So just think how developed they are now. Just think how these programs are so well developed now. We know that Operation Mockingbird has been deflecting stories that they don't want covered in the mass media, killing stories.
What is Operation Mocking? I haven't heard of that. What is that?
Okay, well, that was a CIA program that started way back in the 50s and was revealed in the 1970s. I'm pretty sure it was the Washington Post, Woodward and Bernstein. I'm pretty sure this was like their other famous story that they broke, that they found that in all the big media institutions, including the Washington Post, there's somebody at the very top who can kill any story. And this is how UFO sightings and this kind of narrative have been kept out of the purview of the American public, by extension, the rest of the world. So that's how the mass media is fake. Plus, it's owned by now six conglomerate families. So upper 90% of all media outlets, and we're talking whatever papers remain, news magazines that remain, but more importantly, the TV outlets. And Richard Nixon famously said, the American people won't believe anything until they see it on television. And they know that television is the greatest invention since sliced toast as far as shaping perception. And this is what Leo Zagami calls the egregore, this control of our reality through persistent thought control measures. So when you put out a story on all four networks that's exactly the same but fake, and people go to the cooler the next day and repeat it at work to their colleagues, oh yeah, I saw that too, like, blah, blah, blah.
It reinforces
the egregore.
What story are you talking about, for instance?
Okay, well, it could be the pretense to go to war in Iraq. Okay, remember the woman who was crying on television that they were pulling the babies out of the incubator?
Oh, yeah.
It was totally fake. It's totally false. But when that story came out, everybody believed it was true. Okay, and this is how they can mass hypnotize us. Because all four networks said it was true, turned out to be totally false, 100% fake. But that's how it gets going. That's how the human population can be manipulated through our perceptions. And they're very good at it. And they've been doing it for decades. I did my, I got a degree in marketing and business at Illinois State University. My college thesis was on subliminal programming. This is back in the late 80s. And there was a great book called Subliminal Seduction, which showed how Madison Avenue ad agencies primarily, but it also is true with the mass media, they have worked it down to a science, Alan, how they can manipulate people. And you know the three things in advertising that never go away, that always get a reaction? And this is an example of how malleable and how easily we are manipulated. You know the three things in advertising that never go away?
No, what are the three? No.
So it's like sex or beautiful women. Always catch your attention. Even women, wow, she's so beautiful. Look at the clothes she's wearing. Guys are like, wow, look at that body. That always works. Mm-hmm. Babies always work. You look at commercials way back to the 1950s. Cute little baby always catches your attention, especially women. And pets, cute little dogs and kitty cats. Never goes out of style because they know. You just include one or more of these, even if your ad totally sucks and it's for a product that nobody even really wants or needs, it'll still catch their attention. And most people are passive listeners, especially when the commercials come on. It's like down to about 10% that they won't even hear, say, for example, a new pharmaceutical for an antidepressant may cause suicidal thoughts or things like that. You know, you brush over that, but then you see the image of a first start out like a sad senior citizen, and then the last scene they're happy and playing with the dog. Mm. Yeah, but may cause suicidal thoughts.
Right, people
scan over this, but they do catch the visual cues, and those three will never go away, and they know it. And my point is, they have been manipulating the heck out of us for decades, and they're only getting better.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this has been an amazing overview of reality, in a way. You know. I think the walls are coming down. I think we are starting to see the light because of the internet. Of course, the internet's also part of the brainwashing as well, so... but I think more and more people are waking up. I think you'll be really happy at the turnout at Contact in the Desert because people are there because they want to know the truth, you know, and they are ready for the truth. So, I'm glad you're going to be there and adding this interesting piece of information. Jim Mars has been talking about this stuff too for a while, you know, Jim.
Yep. He's one of my heroes. I can't wait to meet him.
Maybe we should do a special panel on secrecy and the truth in media or something, you know?
Would love it.
I know Richard Dolan talks about that a lot. Linda Moulton Howe, who was in the media. Might be interesting. I'll make a suggestion. But anyway, Brad, thanks so much for this time. What's your website? How can people get in touch with you?
So if they want to learn more about me and the projects I work on, go to www.bradolson.com, O-L-S-E-N, one word, bradolson.com. Or see more of my books or the authors I publish, cccpublishing.com, that's 3 C's in publishing, one word, .com. And I have the Google Books app on CCC Publishing, so I allow people to browse the books and read chapters and check it out, just as if they were going into a bookstore and flipping through the pages. Mm. I also have a YouTube channel called Esoteric Series and various pages that I promote on Facebook, such as Esoteric Book Series, Sacred Places, 108 Destinations, and CCC Publishing. So like us on Facebook and join the conversation. I always like to hear what people think.
Great. Thanks, Brad. Thanks. Good to connect again. It's been a couple of years, but definitely see you out there this summer, and I think it'll be great. I invite everyone who's interested in anything you've heard here tonight to come to Contact in the Desert. That's June 3rd to the 6th at Joshua Tree, California. It's about two and a half hours from L.A., about 40 minutes from Palm Springs. It's right near Desert Hot Springs, which is a great resort place. Hot Springs in the middle of the desert. So you can get tickets at contactinthedesert.com. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. You can find me at newrealities.com or my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/newrealities. Thanks for listening.